Well, hello, good evening, and welcome. My name is Samuel. I am here with you today, and all is very well. It looks like I can hear myself twice on this, which is kind of interesting, and not sure I really like it. So we're going to attempt to turn it on. Trying something new in these troubling room to make sure that things go the way I want them to. And I'm hoping it goes that way, but it sounds like a bit of an echo, which I don't really care for. So I'm going to make sure
that it doesn't occur any longer. We're going to make sure that it goes over this way, and that you can still hear me quite well, and that everything is going exactly the way we want it to, and lots in the news today. So much of it's a movement, a little bit on the crazy side here. So much of it. And I am quite
entertained by what is going on in the world.
I think we're going to start out today.
You are on Dan Radio. This is Samuel Trapp. And we are going to discussing all the current events that happened today and how they affect you and how they, more importantly, affect America. Let us begin with, yesterday I spent a lot of time talking about how several reporters had been killed, and not a word from the press,
not a word anywhere in
the world about this, actually, that we're discussing. And nobody
is talking about how bad this really is for all kinds of things. You know, why in the world are people dying and being killed? We don't like that. I don't think anybody should like that. It's a bad deal for all of us, and you don't
wish that upon anybody as journalists, but it is occurring. It is definitely occurring, and we do not want it to occur at the level that it has been occurring. And I just think that it's truly unfortunate that the world isn't looking out for a journalist at all, in my humble opinion. So let me get to that article for you. This girl was 35 years old. The title of the article is "Another Russian Journalist Killed in Ukraine." And if you remember, I talked about this yesterday. If you're interested in phoning into the program, you are welcome to do so. It is 573-746-8020, and I would be happy to speak with you on any topic that you like, but it'd be nice to stick on the topics that I am discussing, if at all possible. The brief story goes as follows. Anna Prokofieva, a war correspondent for Russia's Channel 1, Первый канал is what it's called in Russia, was killed Wednesday while on assignment in Belgorod. Now, Belgorod borders Ukraine. It's just across the border, right next to the Kursk region. And they attacked all over, you know, the Ukrainians were attacking all over Belgorod in 2023. And then they started going other areas in Kursk after that. So she was reportedly working in the village of Demidovka, an area near active fighting. According to early reports, the 35-year-old journalist was killed by a drone strike or a shrapnel wound, although accounts of the incident differ. Earlier this week, and I reported on this yesterday, three members of a news crew were killed in Ukrainian attacks in Luhansk People's Republic. In recent days, Prokofieva had been reporting from the recently liberated town of Suja. Channel 1 war correspondent Anna Prokofieva was killed in the line of duty. This happened in Belgorod on the border with Ukraine, where Channel 1 news crew hit an enemy mine, said a broadcaster. Her death was reported by military blogger Vladimir Romanov, who wrote that she was killed on Wednesday carrying out an editorial assignment on his Telegram channel. As you know, yesterday I brought the entire article to you about the West ignoring the killing of Russian journalists by the Ukrainian military for the entire length of this war. And they haven't really done much to highlight the fact that there is targeting of Russian journalists in this war. There's so much news that has occurred as a result of, so remember, on Monday the Russians had a 12-hour session on the ceasefire, which the air ceasefire started in last week after talks, and then they were supposed to talk this week. Monday in Riyadh, American group spoke with the Russians all day. Tuesday, they spoke with the Ukrainian side, but for a much shorter time period. And Monday, the Russians had been saying, we're not going to put out a whole lot. There's a very interesting, I listened to my friend cohort, and we're going to play the first part of his because he puts it in a hell of a good way. I could do it the same way, but I'm not going to. We're gonna listen to his take on the entire state of affairs because it's actually pretty funny. He's a funny guy the way he puts it out, and never believe that you're getting the full story, certainly not from the American side. By the way, before I get too far in there, today is my son Andrew Trapp, his, I hate to rat him out about how old he is right now, but he is 38 today. And I remember this day from long, long ago, his age, and I remember where I was. I was in Texas. I was stationed at Fort Hood, which is outside of Killeen. I was with the 2nd Armored Division in the 522nd Military Intelligence Battalion, and I was a Russian interpreter doing not strategic but tactical interpreting. And what that involved was listening to Russian traffic. I was assigned first to a Turkey 32 Victor, which is a machine that did collection, or a Tilkey 17 Alpha, which did jamming. And a 17 Alpha was powerful enough to jam radio stations off of the, I mean, big radio stations, large FM ones, off of the dial for a little while. You could fry their equipment if you wanted, and that was way back when. I shudder to think what they could probably do now. Later, I was assigned to helicopters called Quick Fix. And what they would do, and this is way back when, boy, we thought we were the king shit of Turd Mountain back then. We had these helicopters that I was the commander of 3 helicopters. And you would slave them together to do direction finding and use direction finding equipment to locate where a person was transmitting from. Then you would call in the artillery and destroy a grid square and kill them all. You know, that was the theory and training anyway. But the point of this is I wanted to congratulate my son. Today is his birthday. It is also the birthday of my oldest brother, Clifford Michael Trapp Jr., who sadly for all of us, probably one of the smartest people on the planet. I always used to make jokes that he was so smart that he tended to wander around and bump into walls. He was one of those guys. He skipped two grades in school, finished college at the age of 20, if I recall, might have been 21, but very, very smart. And he did programming of computers at extremely high levels in COBOL, Fortran, back area stuff, way before DOS and all those. And all the programming languages he was very, very involved in. And so he was super, super intelligent. And his birthday was also today. And I bring up birthdays because I, of course, wished my son happy birthday this morning upon awakening. My son Samuel, his birthday is tomorrow. And he is a couple of years younger than Andrew. And his birthday is tomorrow. So they were kind of, close in birthdays. But the birthday of today also, and I didn't know this until I was reading some articles, is Sergei Lavrov, who is the foreign minister of Russia. His birthday also happens to be today. And they were giving him birthday wishes, and it was rather interesting. So anyway, a lot of birthday wishes going on. Before I get too far into listening to a very good summary of what is going on in the war negotiation, yesterday I had read to you this young girl from Ukraine who was distressed when she went to China and discovered that she would actually have to work. And she said, that's not that isn't good. We don't want to work. We're leaving. We're going to go to Poland, and maybe in Poland they will allow us to register as refugees, and we won't have to work. We haven't worked in 2 years in Germany, and it doesn't suit us to go to work. Well, I imagine since I've watched one, now I'm getting a slew of these. I have another one that came out that I'm not going. I wish. Well, I may end up playing it for you. But I'm going to read it to you because it's another lady that is complaining about them, and I want to make sure that the sound doesn't come on because it's kind of pointless to have the sound come up because you don't understand what she's saying anyway. And basically, she's a Russian living in Germany, and her article is like this. I was approached by some volunteers, Ukrainian volunteers, with the request that I allow as guests refugees from Ukraine. And I'm waiting for the translation to catch up. And her name is Svetlana Mandchulenka. And she herself lives in Greece, and there a lady asked wanted to put some people in her home, and I am waiting that she was waiting for her relatives to show up from Ukraine, her daughter with her nieces and nephews, and her another cousin with his children. And they were supposed to come somewhere near 6 o'clock in the evening. And then she said, I am waiting to find out where it's at this, since they're, sorry, it's harder to translate and not listen to it at the same time. She said she is waiting for them to arrive, and so it's going to be a few hours before they arrive. And she said, I have a few questions about the property that I'd like to ask you. What are the situations for living quarters? And I say, well, everything is there. There's a washing machine, there's a dryer, and everything. Yes, there's a refrigerator and a nice size kitchen. And she says, okay, well, that's all very nice, but more importantly, how far is it from the ocean? And she said, what? You know, how far is it from the ocean? What do you mean? And she says, well, what's the distance from the ocean? And she said, well, okay, I was wondering why she was asking this, and I said, well, here's the situation. She said, is it far from the ocean or what? And I said to her, well, it's a half an hour on a bus. You know, you have to take a bus and it'll be a half an hour to get there. And she quit talking to me, and she said, oh, well, I'll call you back later. And that was it. And she said, you know, 2 days have gone by and I haven't heard back from her. She said, this is what's the most important for these people leaving Ukraine. You know, they're not interested in being refugees. They're interested in how far you are from the ocean, you know, and what they're giving. And I've heard so many stories like this. This is why I tried to put them out there. And I wish that had translated a little bit better. It sounds quite a bit more ridiculous in Russian. Well, so this one, here's what they're talking about on the other side of the country. My friend Alex Christoforou, who I listen to pretty frequently, is on the program called The Duran. He always has a good set of history to listen to for us. And we're going to play probably the first 10 minutes or so of his diatribe on this, because a lot has happened. And I have accumulated a bunch of it to read to you. But this guy is very interesting to listen to. And so I'm going to let him just talk about it. And he starts with Russiagate and then gets on to the talks between Russia and the United States. And there's quite a bit that has gone on in that end. But let us listen to what he has to say.
We have a presidential memorandum for your attention. This memorandum requires the immediate declassification of all FBI files relating to the Crossfire Hurricane investigation. This was obviously one of the instances of the weaponization of law enforcement powers of prosecution against you and others. We believe that it's long past time for the American people to have a full and complete understanding of what exactly is in those files.
Which gives the media the right to go in and check it. You probably won't bother because you're not going to like what you see. But this was total weaponization. It's a disgrace. It never happened in this country. But now you'll be able to see for yourselves, all declassified. Is that correct? Would you say? All declassified?
Yes, sir.
Everything?
The FBI file with there's a classified annex, but other than that, we'll put everything in the public eye.
Everything in the public eye.
Is anybody going to look? Huh? What about you?
Makes you wonder.
And frankly, the FBI should be ashamed of themselves, and so should the Department of Justice, and so should Biden.
This is my video update on this Wednesday afternoon, March the 26th. Coming to you from Nicosia, Cyprus. Let's talk about some news. And let's start things off with the release of the Russiagate Crossfire Hurricane documents. Trump announced this yesterday, signing an executive order that the FBI files, all the FBI files in the Crossfire Hurricane Russiagate hoax will be declassified and released to the public. I can't wait. I can't wait to get my hands on these documents.
I can't wait either. These are going to be amazing documents. Everything has been for the last 8 years. Russia, Russia, Russia. Russia's the bad guy. Russia's destroying the world. And everything is Russian disinformation. And I'm very much interested in the Russiagate scandal.
Oh, boy. I bet you there are a lot of people freaking out about the release of the Russiagate hoax documents. A lot of people in the United States, a lot of very powerful people in the United States. I'm looking at you, Adam Schiff, and I bet you a lot of people outside of the United States are freaking out. I'm looking at you, Christopher Steele and Professor Mifsud, if you even exist. Professor Mifsud, we're going to find out if Professor Mifsud ever existed. Stefan Halper and the Five Eyes and who else? Downer from Australia, all these people that were somehow involved in the Crossfire Hurricane Russiagate hoax. I bet you they are freaking out. Can't wait to read these documents. You think Trump is not so fond of Starmer and the UK political class now? Just wait until the Russiagate hoax files are released, and we all get a good look at what the Five Eyes and the UK were up to during the whole Crossfire Hurricane, and you'll see how upset Trump and MAGA are going to be with the MI6 and the UK and the Five Eyes and all of those guys, what they were up to in Trump's first term. A first term that affected the outcome in Ukraine. The Russiagate hoax affected Trump's first term. We got weapons to Ukraine in order for Trump to show that he was the toughest president ever on Russia and on Putin. So we got a huge escalation in Ukraine during his first term. We got the javelins. And no one is tougher on Russia than I am, as he had the whole impeachment Russiagate thing hanging over his head. And then you had all of the hatred and Russophobia cranked up to level 11 on a scale of 1 to 10. The hatred for Russia and for Putin and Putin meddling in the U.S.'s democracy and the U.S. elections and in the collective West elections, that all came out of Russiagate. All of that stuff was a result of Russiagate. So anyway, it is going to be interesting to read these documents. Can't wait for them to be released. Now, let's talk about the U.S.-Russia Black Sea ceasefire, the deal that was reached yesterday, late afternoon, early evening, my time, when I wrapped up.
And this is the funny part. I like how he's going to put all of this together for us, because this chronology of events is why I wanted to play this for you. Plus the Russiagate, you know, this Russia, 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 just like Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. Remember her? We always wanted to complain about Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. But here we go. Listen to Alex more. He puts this together quite well.
My video update in the afternoon, a couple of hours later, we got the news that the U.S. and Russia have agreed to a Black Sea ceasefire, which is very much what the Black Sea grain deal was 2 years ago. But actually, it's even more in Russia's favor this time around. And it was a wild day of news yesterday, because early in the day, we were getting reports that that there was going to be no statement from Russia or the United States as to what happened in Saudi Arabia. The 12-hour talks, there were going to be no statements from either side. Then we had reports which claimed that the Ukraine side, the Zelensky regime, was not happy with the way the talks progressed between Russia and the United States. Then we had an interview from Lavrov, who did not get into the details of the discussions between the U.S. and Russia and Saudi Arabia, but did hint at discussions revolving around a Black Sea ceasefire and stuff like that. But Lavrov also was very clear that Russia was remaining firm on their June 2024 root causes Istanbul Plus position. They were not deviating from those minimum terms during his.
Now, I want to point out to you here one of the reasons that it's important what Lavrov said and the large difference, the extremely glaring difference between Russian foreign policy and Ukrainian foreign policy, because Zelensky came out with a bunch of ridiculous BS that he's ready to start twisting the conversation in his favor. Whatever bits and tidbits you're going to get about the news, twisting it in his favor. Russia, Lavrov, says, well, we're not going to talk about it. There will be no statement until the U.S. Passes on the information to the other side, to Ukraine. And we're not talking about any of this. We're going to evaluate. Remember me telling you that a couple of days ago. We're not going to talk about it. And they were pretty solid government-wide on that, not leaking out information, as is nothing but a U.S. side. You know, we leak everything and pass it out as much as possible. Let us continue. That's why I think this part was important.
His interview with Channel One yesterday. Then we had reports which claimed that the Green Goblin was going to put on a show. He was going to have a press conference. And as Alexander explained during the live stream we did on the Duran, the U.S. got wind, obviously, they got wind of the press conference that Zelensky was about to take on. And they understood that Zelensky was going to get ahead of what was agreed on in Saudi Arabia between the U.S. and Russia, and he was going to spin the narrative in his favor and in Ukraine's favor and try to sabotage the agreement between the U.S. and Russia. So the U.S. beat Zelensky to the punch, and they released a statement as to what was agreed on by the U.S. and Russia. Basically, they announced that Russia and the U.S. had reached an agreement on a Black Sea ceasefire. And then they also announced that there were going to be significant sanctions relief for Russia so that Russia could export their grain and commercial shipping can operate in the Black Sea. And various banks would be connected to SWIFT again, Russian banks. So the U.S. put out this statement. And then after the U.S. put out its statement, the Russians put out a much more detailed statement on what was agreed on during the talks in Saudi Arabia. And both the U.S. and Russia, they beat Zelensky to the punch. Zelensky was not able to shape the narrative to his advantage, and he ended up on the defensive when he had his press conference. Actually, he was very upset, Zelensky, during his press conference, very upset. He was complaining that the United States, they discussed sanctions relief with Russia, but they did not clear it with Ukraine, as if they need clearance from the Green Goblin. Incredible, huh? Man. He really does think he's Churchill, Zelensky. Yeah, that's what he was upset about. That he did not get the clearance. The U.S. did not discuss it with him, so he can give the clearance for some sanctions relief to Russia and to Russian banks. So the documents are online. They're all over social media, what was agreed on. The Russians have posted the statement on various government websites. The U.S. has also posted the agreement as well on their government websites. And just to summarize what was agreed on, you have a Black Sea ceasefire, commercial vessels will now be able to operate in the Black Sea. Military vessels, weapons going into Odessa, will not be able to operate. So the Russians are going to make sure that there is no military cargo that is going to reach the port of Odessa. You're going to have Russian agricultural banks, actually most of the Russian banks that are dealing in shipping and in agriculture, are going to be reconnected to SWIFT, or the U.S. is going to help them reconnect to SWIFT, which means that the U.S. is going to now go to the Europeans, and they're going to tell the Europeans, you're going to have to lift all of your sanctions on the Russian banks that are dealing in commercial shipping and in agriculture. And what else? SWIFT, connected to SWIFT. Insurance as well. That was another big win for Russia. Those ships are going to now be insured. The insurance of the ships. It was a huge win for Putin and for Russia. They gave up nothing in these negotiations, and they got everything and then some. And the main thing that Russia got is they got sanctions relief in a big way. And Zelensky, very upset. The Europeans and the EU, they're going to take a big L from all of this. They're going to have to eventually lift the sanctions and the restrictions that they have on Russian ships and on the agricultural stuff and the banks. And Zelensky, well, he was made a fool of. And he was whining and complaining during his press conference.
I watched that press conference too, and it was entertaining. I don't mean to put the knife in too far, but it's like, man, how can you anticipate that the U.S. is going to do your bidding for you forever? We're not going to, and that the point of view has changed dramatically from where we were not 2 months ago. Well, three, I guess it would be, because it really is only a little more than 2 months ago. The old Biden Zelensky team was, you know, just a horror story for Ukrainians. And frankly, it's actually better for the Ukrainians what's going on now. Some of them may not realize it. I have been trying to listen to some of the Ukrainian channels too, but there are quite a few of them that are spouting off similar things and going, you know, we want peace, we need peace. Zelensky, don't act like his people are totally behind him, because they truly are not. And I want to play for you one more. Item from my history. This one is about 10 minutes worth. The title is called The Deal of the Century, and I want to make sure that when we're going to listen, it's probably about 10 whole minutes of space for this, and we want to listen to it because it goes into some more detail as well on what has been released, and there's some interesting side notes upon it. So here we go.
Hello, my dear friends, you're on the Military of the Summary channel, and today we will discuss the situation in Ukraine on the 26th of March of 2025. Today we have a lot of very interesting updates, so let's start. And this video we're going to talk first of all about the deal of the century that was signed by the Russians today. Basically, it's not just one deal, basically there are two deals that were signed by the Russians. The first deal is about the ceasefire on the energy facilities, and the second deal that was signed by the Russians is the deal on the ceasefire on the Black Sea. So the Russians, as I understand, I've read the documents that were published by the Russians, by the Americans, and by the Ukrainians, and I came to
I've read to some of those too, but I haven't gotten them all. This came out 2 hours ago, so this is pretty recent, his latest update. We're only going to listen to the first 10 minutes of it.
It's a conclusion that the Russians most likely signed the most favorable deal ever since the beginning of probably of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Let's discuss this in details. Let's talk about the benefits, and let's talk about the pluses and assets or benefits that Ukrainians managed to get as a result of this deal. The Ukrainians basically haven't got a lot. They haven't got much, just several things they managed to get from this situation. And first, and probably the only thing, is that according to this deal between the Ukrainians and the United States of America, not between Ukraine and the Russian Federation, Russia is obliged not to move warship beyond the eastern part of the Black Sea, since violation of this point will be considered as a threat to Ukraine's security and grounds for exercising the right to self-defense. What the Ukrainians are trying to tell us. First of all, currently the Russian fleet is located, mainly the Russian fleet is located along the southern part of the Russian Federation or the eastern bank of the Black Sea. So there are lots of ships, lots of different types of submarines, just vessels, just cruise missiles, carriers or something like this. And the Ukrainians are saying that if any Russian ship cross the eastern, let's say, border, and telling the truth is very difficult to understand what does it mean, the eastern part of the Black Sea. Anyway, we believe that there are three parts, western, central and the eastern part, and the Ukrainians are saying if the Russians enter the central part or the western part of the Black Sea, then the Ukrainians will have the right to attack the ships with the missiles. So it's just something like the constitution of fact. Ukrainians had this right in the past, nothing changed, the only just saying that if you do this, we will attack you. You would attack them in any case, so it's not even something that Ukrainians managed to get as something like a benefit as a result of this deal. So this is...
Well, frankly, I don't believe that the Ukrainians are ever going to honor a ceasefire anyway, even a limited ceasefire. They did not honor the limited ceasefire of the last week and a half, where they're not supposed to attack energy infrastructure. They have attacked energy infrastructure. There is no energy infrastructure of Ukraine that has been attacked. They've been attacked all up and down the Ukraine, but they have not been attacked on energy infrastructure. Meanwhile, they have blown up the gas metering station in Kursk and attacked a large gas storage, oil refining storage location in southwestern Russia. Not good. And so I don't believe they'll ever honor these anyway. Let us continue.
It's probably one of the points from the Ukrainian side, one of the most important benefits. And the second one is that according to this deal, the United States of America will help the Ukrainians to return back the prisoners of war. The United States will support the exchange of prisoners, the release of civilians, and the return of Ukrainian children. So, but this is also another process that is ongoing. The Russians always return the Ukrainians the prisoners of war. The only difference in this is that Ukrainians and the Russians usually change their prisoners like for the same number of soldiers. So the Ukrainians return, let's say, 200, and the Russians, let's say, return 200. But the problem is that the ratio of the prisoners of war is currently not in Ukraine's favor. I can't tell you the exact numbers, but let's assume that, for example, the Ukrainians have just 5,000 of prisoners of war, and the Russians have 25,000. So, of course, for the Ukrainians, it is very important not just to return like 10 soldiers for 10 soldiers, one Ukrainian soldier for one Russian soldier. For them, it is much more better to return everybody for everybody, all for all, or at least to have some ratio. And that's why they're asking the United States of America to be in the middle of this process and to help the Ukrainians to return as fast as possible all their Ukrainian soldiers back on the territory of Ukraine.
Well, a lot of points on this, too. A lot of discussion on this has been held over the last few weeks when we've been talking about coming to a ceasefire arrangement and the swapping back prisoners for prisoners, because the Russians are holding a large number. You know, this 5 to 1 is it might be as high as 6 to 1 or 7 to 1. that the Russians are holding, the Ukrainians are holding far less Russian soldiers. And so, like he was saying, you do want to swap them all for all. They want to swap them all for all. And the Russians are going, no, 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 especially those that were held in the Kursk region that were killing civilians, Russian civilians in the Kursk region, or engaged in terrorist activities in the Kursk region of what they were doing. We don't want those people. We don't want to exchange them. That's part number one. Part number two is the Ukrainians immediately send their prisoners of war right back to the front line. And there's a lot of talk anyway that the Ukrainian prisoners of war don't want to go back, because either they'll be thrown right back into the front lines, or they'll be charged with the crimes of treason because they surrendered, because surrendering is a treasonous affair. On the Ukrainian side, even if you're massively outnumbered, even if you have no weapons, even if you have no way to defend yourself and you surrender, that still can be a chargeable offense in Ukraine. There's not a lot of positivity here for those that are going home. You're going to be sent right back to the front lines and, you know, to the meat grinder on the front lines. And Ukraine is not winning, okay? They're just not. And their soldiers know it, which is why these people, surrendered anyway. Let's keep on going.
So probably that's it. These are the only benefits that Ukrainians managed to get as a result of this deal. Of course, we're talking about the ceasefire on the energy facilities. Of course, we're talking about some possibilities Ukrainians will be able to trade with their products with the world. But I'm not sure that this is just a regular situation, you know. There is nothing that we can say that this will improve or increase the strength of Ukraine and the armed force of Ukraine. But when talking about the Russians, here we can see completely different picture and completely different story. Let's discuss them in details. First of all, of course, the Russians will also receive access to the Black Sea. They will be able to trade. This is very important. And the United States of America promised the Russians that Ukrainians will never use vessels, will never use commercial vessels for military purposes. And this is one of the most important benefits for the Russians, because the Ukrainians, since the beginning of the special military operation, used a lot of vessels as the carriers for missiles, as the carriers for drones that then Ukrainians used to attack Crimea, to attack, let's say, Novorossiysk and many other Russian regions. And now the Ukrainians will not be able to do this. Obviously, this is a very important benefit for the Russians. Another important thing is that the Russians, according to this deal, not the Russians, that the United States of America, according to this deal, must lift the sanctions. Just take a look at this official statement of Kremlin. There are several paragraphs here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraphs. And these paragraphs tell us that before the beginning of the ceasefire on the Black Sea, the United States of America must do 5 things. And I would like to point your attention that every single point starts with the lifting, the removal. So every single statement means that the United States of America, first of all, must remove something, must lift something from the Russians. Let's discuss in details. The lifting of sanctions from Rossiljhozbank and other financial institutions involved in the insuring operations on international trade in food and fertilizers, their connection to SWIFT. So the Russians are saying that if you want this deal to be signed, you need to connect the Russians to SWIFT, and obviously.
So this Rossiljhozbank is a Russian selskohozyaystvennyy. It's like the U.S. grain bank, but it's the Russian grain bank. It's a very big deal. And so if they have to turn it, that bank in particular, which funds and takes care of anything agriculture related, it allows them to start doing trade in the West. And remember, there were two parts to this grain deal, this Ukrainian Black Sea grain deal, and the Ukrainians lost the ability So the Russians agreed to this grain deal for about a year, but that expired about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago almost. And so the Ukrainians aren't able to go through the Black Sea to deliver their grain. Of course, they've lost a buttload of it anyway over there. But the Russians have been limited in what they can do, but the Russians already have a five-year grain deal that isn't expiring for another 2.5 or 3 years. And if they can get the ability to continue with that, it was limited by sanctions, but the contracts are still active. And so that will allow them to get a little bit of, quite a bit of inflow of capital from this. So the Russians got, that's only point one on the lifting of sanctions. So this bank gets turned back into the Russ-Selkhoz Bank, gets to be turned back on to SWIFT, which means what? That means you can now trade in Russian, Russian currency, can trade with the West, not just with SWIFT, I'm sorry, BRICS countries. They can be turned back into the Western banking systems. And this is a big deal, but only for what's going on in the Black Sea. And Russia doesn't have to agree to a Black Sea ceasefire until these five things are done by the United States. So they got something very good out of this, and Ukraine didn't get much at all. Let's keep going.
This is very important benefit. Another important thing, removal of restriction on trade finance transactions. Once again, SWIFT and many, many other finance different tools that the Russians may use. Removal of sanctions from companies producing and exporting food. Removal of restrictions on servicing ships in ports and sanction from ships under the Russian flag involved in the trade of food. This is very important because in this case, for example, the European countries will not be able to arrest the Russian ships in the Baltic Sea, because during the previous months we got lots of cases when Germany, Finland, Norway were arrested different ships that were moving from Russian. Basically, those ships were Russian ships, but they were moving under another flag. So that's why they arrested them without any consequences. Removal of restriction on the supply of agricultural machinery to the Russian Federation, as well as other goods involved in the production of food and fertilizers. So what does this deal mean, and both these deals means for the Russians? The most important thing is that this deal doesn't tell the Russians, doesn't force the Russians to stop the special military operation, or to stop the war, or to stop the Russian offensive operation. This deal doesn't mean anything like this. If you want to continue war, this deal says, tells the Russians, you can do whatever you like. The only thing you must do, not to attack the energy facilities and not to use ships for military purposes. And that's it. So basically, this deals, first of all, means the following. The Russians will be able to continue the special military operation, but without sanctions. Without sanctions, with a lot of money, a lot of resources, and very good relations with the United States of America. So basically, everything will be the same for the Russians, just with one very important exception. The Russians will have no sanctions from the United States of America. Telling the truth, this is the perfect situation for the Russians to start advancing significantly and along the entire line of combat contact, or whatever they like and whatever they want. Obviously, the deal of the century was signed by the Russians, and telling the truth, Zelensky and Ukraine can't do anything with this. Of course, they will try to ruin this negotiation process. They will try to ruin this peace agreement, this ceasefire, and they have a lot of tools how to do this. First of all, we discussed this in the previous video, that for both sides, for the Russians and for the Ukrainians, the ceasefire on the energy facilities ends in different times. The Russian ceasefire ends on the 17th of April, the Ukrainian ceasefire ends on the 25th of April, and most likely Zelensky will use the situation to blame the Russians in falling down the entire process, and then they will break and quit this entire negotiation, this talks process, and everything will start from the beginning. A lot of ways for the Ukrainians how to do this, because if the situation continues developing exactly as it now, as it is written in the documents provided by the Russians, by the Ukrainians and the United States of America, then in 3-4 months the situation for Ukraine will be much more difficult and much worse in comparison with current one. Now let's discuss the situation.
And that was a pretty reasonable, you know, a very good analysis between both those guys. When you listen to both of them, that's why I thought we would have them join us in. It's quite interesting the perspectives that they put out on this, and both of them are on other sides of the planet. The Duran, that channel with Alex Christoforo and Alex, there's another guy, and both of them happen to be named Alex, and they speak oftenly on this channel called The Duran. And The Duran, there's a guy in England named Alex, and then this other guy, Alex Christoforo, who lives in Cyprus, and they both they have their own channel, and they speak. I don't necessarily like the ones where they talk back and forth. I like Christoforo's quite a bit more than I like the other Alex's, although when sometimes I do listen to them both together. But they're very well versed in all of the details of what is going on and what it means. They also do quite a bit on the Gaza scenario and in the Middle East. Now, I don't know much about that. I read up on it, and I don't want to say I don't want to know. I know quite a bit, but I wouldn't feel comfortable telling you much about what's going on in there. But the Russian stuff, a lot of the times, I've read a lot of the same things that they do, and it kind of, you know, my thought processes sometimes get a little bit confirmed that, I got that right, you know what I mean? And so these are very intelligent guys that are putting out very good information on this. I want to get into quite a bit more news that we have here that has come up. I talked to you yesterday about the Kremlin slamming the international reaction to Ukraine killing, and that another person was killed there today. It's really a shame that there's not enough news about that, or that people are saying these that aren't condemning these types of activities. So one of the ones that I did want to talk to quite a bit, a month or two ago, maybe a little bit longer, I told you about our department. Well, no, it had to be longer than that, because it was the DOJ under the Biden administration, and I haven't had a chance to go back and see whether that's changed any in the current environment, or whether it's still the case. There's an article that came out, and I'm going to read this to you. This came out at about 3 hours ago, and it has a picture on the front of it that says, "We are not going away." And then it says, underneath it, it's written in Russian, "We не уйдем," which means we aren't going away. And then underneath it, there's a square green RT, which is the symbol for Russia Today, Russian television. It's a their equivalent of Voice of America, I suppose. And it's where I read a lot of content from. And it's got a little bit of propaganda, but I have quite a bit of it. Now remember, the State Department put something... not the State Department, Department of Justice under Biden was filing charges against people and stealing all of their property if they happened to be related to this Russia Today, RT. And there's lawsuits filed against them with conspiracy sorts of charges, bullshit charges, pardon my French. But the most important charge is the... ability to have your property seized, and so they can take your property if you're involved in some kind of a conspiracy. They can do a government forfeiture part and take your home, take your bank accounts, and that's what they've been doing against any of these RT people. And I did some reporting on that back in November, I want to say, when some of these were going around, and they were very much talking about how they were seizing property from these people. That was the main thrust of everything they were trying to do. So, article came out here a couple hours ago that says, and I'll read you the article that came out on RT. It's very interesting because I researched quite a bit of it before my show started today. It says, U.S. intelligence warns of Russian media threat. Okay. Moscow's influence activities are expected to intensify and become more sophisticated, a new report has claimed. And that is especially in Russiagate, these Russiagate things that Alex was talking about, all of this news being put out about how Russia really wasn't a threat, and these FBI probes are all being released and declassified. And I'm very interested to see what they come out, and all these people that lied to us all during 2015, right? So Russia is, here's how the article goes. And remember, this is written by RT correspondents. Who's the one that has written this one? We don't know. But it's their newspaper that it's coming from. Russia is using a variety of entities, including RT, to shape public opinion and stoke division in the U.S., an American intelligence report claims. The allegation was made in the 2025 annual threat assessment of the U.S. intelligence community, which was made available to the public on Tuesday. I downloaded a copy, you should too. The document is said to reflect the collective insights of the United States' spy agencies. The authors claim that Moscow uses influence activities to counter threats, including by stoking political discord in the West, sowing doubt in democratic processes and U.S. global leadership, degrading Western support for Ukraine, and amplifying preferred Russian narratives. Okay, so basically, according to this 2025 annual threat assessment from the U.S. intelligence community, Russiagate is still alive and very, very well. And a lot of the so-called experts, I don't believe they're really experts. I think this is just nonsense, okay, that this is what they're doing. Although, by the way, we do the exact same thing in reverse. You know how we all like to, at least on the government side, we all like to accuse those of exactly what we are doing. So here's what else they say. Russia employs so-called troll farms. Apparently I'm in the troll farm. I would be one of that group. Which spread information through fake accounts and state media outlet RT in its efforts to covertly shape public opinion in the U.S., amplify and stoke domestic division, and discreetly engage Americans while hiding Russia's hand. The document reiterated accusations of Russian meddling in U.S. elections. Russia, which Moscow has consistently denied, claiming that Russia probably believes such information operation efforts are advantageous regardless of whether they affect election outcomes, because reinforcing doubt in the integrity of U.S. electoral system achieves one of its core objectives. Don't you find that a little bit amusing, that the core objectives of the United States are, or of Russia, are being forwarded to you by Samuel Trapp, of course. They don't say that, of course, obviously. Who the hell knows me, and how am I that important? I'm really not. But I do put out my own brand of, call it disinformation, by agreeing to review some of Russia, and how important it is to discuss these type of things. I find it rather amusing. But let us continue with the article and see where we go. Moscow's malign influence activities will continue for the foreseeable future and will almost certainly increase in sophistication and volume, the paper suggests. The threat assessment was released amid efforts by Russia and the administration of U.S. Donald Trump to find a diplomatic solution to the Ukraine conflict and normalize relations between Moscow and Washington. On Monday, Russian and U.S. experts held 12-hour talks in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, agreed to revive the defunct Black Sea Grain Initiative, which envisioned the safe passage of Ukrainian agricultural process in exchange for the West lifting sanctions in Russian grain and fertilizer. Last September, the outgoing administration of U.S. President Joe Biden announced a new raft of curbs targeting several Russian media outlets, accusing them of attempting to undermine democracy and interfere in U.S. elections. Then Secretary of State Antony Blinken alleged that RT was functioning as a de facto arm of Russian intelligence, those lawsuits that they filed against or criminal charges that they filed against people who worked for RT so they could seize their property, you know, that those aren't undermining democracy at all, yes? Moscow condemns these restrictions and has, you know, continued to do so, saying that Washington has declared war on the freedom of speech. I happen to agree with that analysis. Earlier this month, American journalist Ben Swan, who previously headed RT's operations in the U.S., urged the Trump administration to lift the sanctions, arguing that they were unconstitutional and violated the rights of freedom of the speech and a freedom of speech and the press. Interesting, huh? very, very comical what is going on in the world. So, as I told you earlier, Lavrov gave a long interview yesterday evening on Channel 1, Russian Channel 1, and I have listened to it in Russian, and I happened to find a transcript of it, so I'm going to take a couple of those questions and pass them on to you, and, you know, we can proceed from there. But before that, I wanted to talk about this crossfire hurricane one more time and what this, the 2016 investigation into the U.S. president's alleged Russia ties was launched by the FBI. And U.S. President Donald Trump has ordered the declassification of all those files. This investigation occurred in 2016, started in July, to examine whether Trump, as a candidate, were colluding or coordinating with Moscow to influence the election. In a memorandum released Tuesday, Trump directed the Attorney General to make the materials available to the public immediately. Crossfire Hurricane was prompted by the Steele dossier, a compilation of unverified rumors about Trump and his alleged links to Russia. The dossier was compiled by former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele, and funded by the Hillary Clinton campaign. Crossfire Hurricane preceded the appointment of special counsel Robert Mueller, whose subsequent Russiagate investigation found no evidence of collusion between Trump campaign and the Russian government. In 2023, the U.S. Justice Department Special Counsel John Durham, appointed to review the origins of the Crossfire Hurricane probe, concluded that the FBI and DOJ had failed to uphold their mission by relying on biased information to surveil Trump. Durham criticized the FBI for showing a serious lack of analytical rigor, particularly when handling information from politically affiliated sources. It also revealed that the Steele dossier had been used by the FBI to obtain court permission to spy on the Trump campaign. In 2019, Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz reported that the FBI made basic, fundamental, and serious errors in its warrant applications. Crossfire Hurricane and Mueller's Russiagate investigation cast a long shadow over Trump's presidency, with allegations of Russian collusion persisting in the media even after Mueller's report found no evidence to back them up. In a video posted on Tuesday, Trump said after signing the order, "This was total weaponization. It's a disgrace. But now you'll be able to see for yourselves. You probably won't bother because you're not going to like what you see." We all know that. Sorry to repeat it, but there you go. Trump had previously ordered a full declassification of Crossfire Hurricane during the final days of his first term, but the documents were never released. According to a 2023 CNN report, a binder containing highly classified information later went missing. Yeah. Good stuff, huh? Now, I want to get to a couple of the Lavrov questions here. And remember, it was his birthday, and his interview happened to be was released yesterday, but I think they met last night. I wonder, I hope I'm not incorrect, and maybe his birthday was yesterday and not today, so not the same day as my son's. But anyway, first they spent a little bit of time on his birthday greetings, and then the very first question given to him of any substance was, "The talks in Riyadh are important. What was their objective, and what is the outcome? Please share your thoughts on this." Sergei says, "The outcome is that the preliminary results are being reported to President Putin and President Trump. As the presidents agreed earlier, the participants focus primarily on safe navigation in the Black Sea. This is not the first time they are trying to address this matter. The first attempt dated back to July 2022. Back then, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and President of Turkey Recep Tayyip Erdogan mediated with the specialists who represented the Ukrainian and Russian entities in question and came to terms on a certain package that was made up of two parts. The first part provided fast-track solutions to shipping Ukrainian grain across the Black Sea via the straits that include ship inspections to preclude cheating, where empty runs for a new batch of grain could be used to deliver weapons. Inspection procedures have been agreed upon and remained operational for the entire year. However, we were then forced to suspend the process, at least to pause it, because the second part of the deal that concerned removal of the obstacles to Russian grain and fertilizer exports was sabotaged. All ships that carried Russian agricultural products, including fertilizer, have been blacklisted. Lloyd's, the insurer, hiked up the rates. Payments for our products were impeded as well. Selkoskoe's bank was disconnected from SWIFT. Much was done to send grain prices sky high, oil and fertilizer. European farmers created unfair competition. However, our Western colleagues acted in a biased manner and dumped substandard Ukrainian grain on European markets. The West was doing everything it could to skew the rules in favor of Ukraine and to punish the Russian Federation as much as it could. A year after the Black Sea Initiative had taken effect, UN Secretary General Guterres said he was unable to make things right. We suggested going back to this deal whenever he regains the ability to get things right. We just bailed out from the Ukraine side of the deal, which was approved to last 1 year. That year ran out, and we did not renew that deal. The Memorandum of Understanding between the Russian Federation and the Secretariat of the UN on promoting Russian food products and fertilizer to the world markets, Russian grain and fertilizer exports make up a larger share of the world market than Ukrainian, that will remain in effect through July 2025. So it's important for them to want to continue this. Then UN Secretary General Guterres and his representatives maintained contacts with us at all times and have been trying to help. However, they are not trying to have sanctions imposed upon us lifted and are not demanding that the West, if it generally wants to advance the interests of developing countries, the global majority, primarily Africa, cancel its discriminatory food security policies. So Russia wants to get most of its stuff to the global South, who does a lot of their business through BRICS, by the way, just so you know. And UN Secretary General Guterres chose another path and started looking for loopholes in the Western sanctions without demanding to lift them altogether. Moreover, he did so while complying with these sanctions and acting upon them, which is unacceptable for any UN official. The UN Charter says that no member of the UN Secretariat, including the Secretary General, can receive directives from any government. If the UN Secretary General is looking for loopholes with regard to sanctions, thus recognizing that they exist, he has, in fact, been acting upon decisions that are made in the capital of UN member states, which is something he cannot do. How do you like that? That's why Lavrov is such a good foreign minister. I mean, my God, this guy has been around forever and he knows what he's doing. That is why our negotiators in Riyadh, who were assigned for this mission by Putin, reminded their U.S. counterparts of this incident and said that given Ukraine's track record and the Black Sea incidents in question, we would like to leave ambiguity out of whatever agreement we reach this time. We noted that when the Ukrainian part of the initiative expired in 2023 and we withdrew from it, President of Turkey Recep Tayyip Erdogan tried to renew it on two or three occasions. A year ago, he asked for our support to fast-track the renewal of the initiative without conducting physical inspection of empty ships after grain and fertilizer was unloaded. Well, because Russia claims that they loaded them back up with military hardware from the West and shipped it back to Odessa. We were willing to meet them halfway even then. Then at the last moment, Erdogan said Vladimir Zelensky wanted to reach an agreement on not targeting nuclear infrastructure, even though Zelensky was the only one to attack the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Considering the fact that this proposal came from Kiev, we agreed to it without recurring to any special verification mechanisms. In other words, we met all Erdogan requests, including the one that Zelensky slipped to him at the last moment, for purposes that remain unknown. But we agreed anyway. Later, Erdogan called President Putin and said Zelensky had a change of heart. Every time a ceasefire has been declared, Ukraine agreed to it solely because it found itself in desperate straits on a battlefield at that particular moment. A couple of weeks or a couple of months into the ceasefire, they grossly violate it. This is how things have been going throughout the time frame of the Minsk Accords. That is why this time we need clear, concrete, verifiable, workable guarantees and mechanisms. As President Putin said at his news conference with President of Belarus Lukashenko a few days ago, he was supportive of Trump's initiative to declare a ceasefire for 30 days, not just a moratorium on strikes on energy infrastructure or on maritime infrastructure in the Black Sea. He said, "We're all for it." However, considering the length of the contact line, the ability of the Ukrainian military to stage provocations, they don't believe it'll work. Recently, they attacked the Suja gas metering station and claim Russia did it, even though the station is our property and a number of European countries depend upon it for uninterrupted energy supply. It is impossible to do so now, just as it is impossible to use the Caspian pipeline, in which Kazakhstan and the U.S. have business interests. One of its pumping stations, which is Kropotkinskaya, came under attack as well. The damage it sustained cannot be undone quickly. The volume of oil pumped to European households has dropped dramatically because of this attack by the Ukrainians. It's a long answer to the question. He's a very versed person, and he makes some pretty good answers. Here's the second question. Can the U.S. and the Trump administration influence Europe today? Why is nothing happening? Meaning, why are they still so anti-Russia in Europe? Both President Trump Lavrov says, both President Trump and his team made it clear that certain issues were off limits. Territorial matters must be discussed, not just as a question of land, but because they involve the people who live there and who have chosen to link their futures with Russia. It was also stated that no weapons should be supplied there. On all three points, President Zelensky acted defiantly. After insulting Donald Trump at the White House, he went to London, where he was warmly received. Upon returning to Kiev, he made a series of bold statements rejecting both neutral status and any discussion on territorial issues. His stance is, give us everything. And what does that mean? It means banning everything Russian, outlawing the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is a sister church to the Russian Orthodox Church, suppressing Russian media and education. Now the Rada, that's the legislative branch on the Ukrainian side, is even considering a bill to forbid speaking Russian during school breaks. It's already been banned during lessons themselves. And yet, they expect to reintegrate people who, in a referendum, declared that they are Russian. These people say, if we had been granted our rights, we would have remained Russian citizens of Ukraine. But instead, you are trying to eradicate us, both physically and legally. In this situation, Europe is not only disregarding Donald Trump and his team's assessment that territorial issues must be resolved outside of NATO influence, it is actively encouraging Zelensky's stance. When European leaders speak of peacekeeping forces or security forces, they are essentially seeking to secure control over the territories Kiev currently holds or will hold by the time any agreement is reached, placing them under British or French oversight. No one acknowledges that in these regions that have not returned or are in the process of returning to Russia, linguistic, educational, and cultural rights are fully protected for Russians as well as for national minorities. Meanwhile, if what remains of Ukraine falls under the control of NATO-backed security forces, regardless of the flag they operate under, no one is talking about strengthening democracy there. No one is calling for a repeal of racist, Russophobic laws that seek to erase Russian identity. If that is the case, then these so-called security forces will only serve to perpetuate a Nazi regime, one that bans anything reminiscent of Ukraine's Russian heritage, despite the fact that the country was created by Russians. That's pretty deep, isn't it? It's I thought this way for a long time, and a lot of people do. You know, that, man, what in the world are you, why are you trying to deny where you came from, Ukraine? Ukraine has never existed as Ukraine. Never. Except under the Soviet Union, when it started to exist, was it Nikita Khrushchev who expanded Ukraine and turned it into the borders it was at the time the Soviet Union dissolved? But before that, they were never their own country, never. Never was there a separate Ukrainian government, a separate Ukrainian anything. There was a guy, Bandera, who was a Nazi supporter and wanted to kill Russians back at the time of all of World War II, and killed 100,000 Polish in Lvov and in other places, but not any separate Ukraine. It just never was part of anything. There was a group of people who supported German activities against Russians in Ukraine. Here's another question. What is the worth of such agreements if an oil depot was attacked immediately after Putin accepted Trump's proposal to halt attacks on energy structure for 30 days, which we were not doing anyway? It looks like a vicious cycle. How much must we withstand? The attack took place a day after the president's conversation. That's the attack on the natural gas pipeline metering station in Kursk. And Sergei Lavrov says, there are many more examples of this kind. I used to say that the Kiev regime does not honor agreements. More than that, these characters do not just disregard agreements, but have demonstrated a new quality, complementing a desire to cheat with the intention to openly, publicly, and spitefully play nasty tricks in a direct contravention to what they have been asked, seemingly agreed to do. Well, and I would point out again, and I have a photo of it, and it was Zelensky giving, and I talked about it some yesterday, Zelensky giving a press conference where he supports a ceasefire, standing in front of a new painting in his residence of a painting of the burning Kremlin behind him, the Kremlin, Russian Kremlin in Red Square in Moscow, burning. So this is a guy who's very much in the mood for peace, yeah? If he's going to do that, you know, he'll say one thing, but show something completely different. And it's nonsense. On March 11, 2025, the Kiev regime stated in Jeddah for the first time that it accepted the 30-day ceasefire. It immediately shifted responsibility to Russia, saying that we must accept the initiative immediately and implicitly. People like Macron, Starmer, and von der Leyen shouted that the ball was in President Putin's court, although 3 days before that, they had rejected a ceasefire deal, saying that weapons should be pumped into Ukraine before any negotiation so that it can act from a position of strength. But they changed their stance as soon as they received the weapons and the wind shifted. On March 11, when the Ukrainians and Zelensky said they were ready for a ceasefire and the task was to force President Putin to do the same, they sent a record large number of drones, about 340, into central Russia, including Moscow and the Moscow region. It was the largest drone attack ever, but the West, swallows that insult. Nobody expressed any shock at the Ukrainians doing that after publicly expressing a readiness for a ceasefire. Did they wait for Russia to respond? All 340 drones were launched at civilian facilities. The same is happening now. When the meeting in Riyadh was prepared, we agreed with the Americans, based on agreements made by Putin and Trump, that it would be attended by Russian and U.S. experts. But it looks like the active people in the West are eager to put something on paper as soon as possible, so they invited the Ukrainians to Riyadh as well. The Ukrainians arrived a day before the meeting and stayed after the Russian experts left. Just between us, even though I don't think it's a big secret, we sensed before the Riyadh meeting that the Americans wanted to place Russians and Ukrainians in adjacent rooms, engaging in shuttle diplomacy to ultimately produce a coordinated document. However, we reiterated what our president discussed. Our unequivocal stance, which has been agreed by our presidents, is that progress must be reliable and there must not be any unsubstantiated documents. Even if some documents are adopted under guarantees, our American colleagues are to ensure that the Kiev regime complies with these guarantees. That is the point. Europe is trying to undermine Washington's role in the Ukrainian settlement. It does not want to settle it by removing the root cause of the crisis. I have already mentioned these root causes. NATO, he means NATO membership for Ukraine. The legal and physical destruction of Russian speakers' rights to their own language, their own history, their own culture, and everything associated with Russia. How about that? Question. At the same time, Steve Witkoff has stated optimistically that a ceasefire could be agreed to by Easter, that is, within a month, although he previously stated it would be achieved within 2 weeks. Do you share this optimism? I know that you are not paid to be optimistic. So Lavrov says, some people often compare Soviet customs and traditions with the current developments in Western countries, like fulfilling five-year plans in 4 years. After we abandoned atheism, the deadline has been set for Easter. It could have been Christmas with the same result. That is not how I would formulate the question. I understand Steve Witkoff. He is clever and energetic person who thinks that everyone should be aware of things he regards as obvious. Judging by the statements he made during his conversation with Tucker Carlson, the essence of this conflict is clear to him, but he overestimates the European elites who want to prevent Zelensky from showing weakness. Zelensky doesn't want to show weakness either. He knows that his days are numbered and is positive, and that his positive image that he has cultivated among the people has long since faded, with the exception of those who hold radical, far-right, and revenge-seeking Bandera views. I happen to agree with that entirely. Let's see here. See if we got any other questions. Well, I don't. That one's a long answer, so I'm not going to read it, and we're not going to stay here that long. Do not have any illusions mean that we will act differently with our relations with the United States? Which mistakes we possibly made before won't be repeated? And Sergei Lavrov says, trust but verify. It is a signature phrase of Ronald Reagan, which President Trump has recalled. We won't forget it. It is a combination of a civilizational view of the current development stage when national interests should become a priority, when it has become clear that globalism has been destroyed, including through the actions of the previous U.S. administration. They started using the dollar as a weapon. Donald Trump said after the elections that before he assumed office that it was a bad mistake, if not a crime, of Biden to use the dollar to punish certain countries. As a result, not only those he wanted to punish by preventing them from using the dollar, but also those others critically, critically assessed the situation. They were punishing Russia, Iran, Venezuela, and several other countries. What if they didn't like someone else? You remember that Joe Biden offended Saudi Arabia and then had to go there, you know, by doing that, by all this dollar talk that people can't use the dollar. And Lavrov says, all countries think more or less alike. Anyone who is not on the blacklist now might fall out of favor with the U.S. administration at any time, considering that each new administration can cancel agreements made by the previous administration. To be on the safe side, they are thinking about replacing the dollar and the euro with natural currency and mutual settlement, even if not creating a new currency altogether. Europeans are even less predictable. Discussions of payment mechanisms such as BRICS Pay are very much underway, and this process will not be reversed. And I'm going to stop right there when we talk about that, because I'm telling you that the BRICS organization is critical to the role of the U.S. And if people don't believe it, that ball has been rolling, and it ain't a stopping. That ball's going to continue to roll, ladles and jelly spoons, because these countries are trading with each other outside of the dollar. And it's an enormous amount of trade. 40% of the world trade now, where literally 80 to 100% was done through the dollar before, through SWIFT banking, through all of those. But now these mechanisms exist to allow these countries to accept each other's currency through their own national banking systems, through this BRICS Pay, which isn't finalized yet, but they're still doing it. All of the trade between India and Russia, of all of it, the oil, very little of it, is done with the dollar. So the combination of these two things should frighten Americans quite a bit, because we are the most in debt country in the world, and it was done on the backs of the rest of the world, having to use the dollar, and every time a transaction was conducted between Russia and China, for example, which is a lot of trade, that it had to go through the banking systems of the West, including SWIFT, and the banks took their cut. The West took their cut. The U.S. pumped out more dollars because everybody needed more dollars. Well, but if they're taking their own country's currency now and found a mechanism to pay these through any sort of BRICS pay mechanism or through cryptocurrency, which is very popular these days, the dollar, these two factors, BRICS pay and the debt of the United States, are going to kick the crap out of the dollar eventually. I'm not calling it tomorrow. I'm not even calling it in 5 to 10 years. We're still an extremely strong country, strongest in the world. But these motions that have been set in place are not going to end anytime soon. And this ball is already rolling, and it's gathering more and more momentum the further it goes down the line. And I think it is important that people understand that it really is an important scenario, you know, that we need to pay a little bit more attention to than we are. I think that if you're not paying attention to it, you kind of need to pay attention to these sorts of news and events that come out. I tell you what, I'm going through my last pile of daily news before I end this a discussion with us today, and let's see what else there is to talk about. I think that is basically all I want to play for today, and we shall in that case we shall end on a beautiful note and my theme song, if you don't mind.